The next number today will be a request performance. We have asked Dean Martin if he would tell his life story. He demurred for a while, but finally consented to do it. And I'm sure you'll agree when you're through with this hour that it has been one of the most inspirational stories you could hear. Dr. Thomas L. Martin.
My brothers and sisters, I'd much rather give a gospel sermon than talk about my life, because I feel as though the topic would lend itself more to a fireside chat. But when I'm asked, why, I obey. And I'd like you to know, too, that there isn't a faculty man on this staff whose life story wouldn't make mighty interesting reading. And it's one of the most interesting things to associate with. I was born 65 years ago, a little over. And I was the only one that lived out of the first five children that were born. It was just a little difficult in England when my father was a coal miner and my mother was a factory worker to have those children properly looked after. And I just took upon myself practically every disease that was known to childhood. And I wasn't able to walk until I was 5 years of age. Then I started school when I was 6 years of age, and about that time my father and mother joined the church. And somehow or other, things had changed. And all of the children that were born after that, I was the oldest of 14 children, and all of the children that were born after these first five, somehow or other, they seemed to get along all right. There was a new lease on life, or a new interpretation of life, and it had its effect upon the children. And all the children are large. I'm the only one that's small in the whole family. And mine was an acquired characteristic. And I do not necessarily transmit that to my offspring. If you get acquainted with my offspring, you'd find that they're just quite a little larger than their father happens to be. Because mine was a nutritional problem. I started school. Somehow or other, I was just a little backward. And I well remember up until the third grade that I just seemed to not be able to take hold of things at all. And it was time for me to be promoted to the fourth grade. And I remember the schoolmaster and the teacher talking and just pitying me and looking upon me as rather hopeless. And then finally the schoolmaster says, "Oh, let him go. He can't hurt us." And I went into the fourth grade, and somehow or other I found myself in that grade. And from that time to this, I haven't felt dumb. I may have acted that way. And then after that, in the fifth grade, it was decided that inasmuch as my father had eight children at that time, father and mother had eight children, and they wanted to come to Zion, now how were they going to get to Zion? And there was only one thing to do, and that was to send Thomas to Zion and let him earn money to send back to England to bring the family to the United States. And my father had always had an attitude of education for me. I never noticed him do that with the rest of the family. And he said, "Now, when you become a man, I want you to be so educated that when you looked at this particular tap and the water running out of that tap, you'd know exactly just how many gallons of water were coming out of that tap." That was his idea of an education for me. It had its influence because it made me feel that I must go somewhere in an educational way. And I used to go to bed at 6 years of age and 7 years and 8 years of age, and I used to dream of something happening to me at a later date. And I well remember just lying there and thinking about Horatio at the bridge. I don't know whether any of you know that or not, but that's a poem that we have to learn in the schools there. And of course it's Horatio standing at the bridge and 400 of those enemy Spartans trying to get across that bridge, but this hero Horatio would kill them as fast as they'd come. And there I saw myself as this man Horatio. Then that gave place to seeing myself stand before a group of men and women and talking to them. It wasn't children, it wasn't young people, it was just men and women. And I was teaching them, and I was preaching to them, talking to them. And I used to see myself doing that, and I just thrill. And then the next morning, I'd wake up to that wonderful vision that I'd had of seeing myself somewhere. And it had its influence on me, it did something to me, and made me want to become something in this life. Then in the fifth grade, now then, if Thomas is going to become educated, he should stay in school and keep going. But no, we'll send him into the coal mines. And I was 12 years of age at that time, and it was decided that I should go to the coal mines and earn money enough to get enough passageway to bring myself to Utah. Then when I got to Utah, I'd work and save my money, send it back home, and bring them to this area. Well, I remember in the fifth grade, the school teacher said to all of the youngsters that were in there, and they're all coal miners' sons and daughters, "What are you going to be, John?" "Or coal miner." "What are you going to be, Harry?" "A coal miner." "What are you going to be, Thomas?" "A school teacher." Well, that rather shocked the whole crowd, and I well remember the schoolmaster just thinking that was the biggest joke he'd ever heard. Because he would say he'd be chalking on the board, and suddenly put his finger to his nose, and he'd say, "John, school teacher. Harry, school teacher." And then I was the laugh. Well, before the fifth grade was over, it was possible for a boy to quit school at 12 years of age and work in the coal mines if he could pass a labor examination. And there were about 40 people from that district that were asked to take this examination, so they could start to work in the coal mines. Well, I was one of the 3 out of the 40 that happened to pass. Then I went over to the school, to the gaffer there at the coal mines, and wanted a job. And he said, they're not very big. And it said, "What do you want to come to work here for? Why don't you go to school?" I said, "Well, I belong to the Mormon Church, and my father and mother want to emigrate to Utah, and I want to earn enough money so I can emigrate myself and then earn money in Utah to send back to the folks, to bring the folks back to Utah." And he looked up and he laughed. He said, "Well, go get the lamp." And, of course, that meant that I was employed. Well, it was very interesting. While I was working in the coal mines, I must have been an awkward youngster, because I wouldn't yield to this, and I was a nuisance. Well, Mother said that I was always fighting. She says, "Hey, lad, I don't know how in the world I raised thee, because I'd fight anybody, and no matter how big they were, I was always in trouble. And I was in trouble in the coal mine, too. And when they get after me, I'd say, 'Well, does thou know I wasn't made for pit?' Meaning, don't you know that it's not intended that I should be a man that worked in the pit? I was headed for bigger things. See, I had conceit, even in that early days." I was successful in earning the money. Then I emigrated, came here, and then came to Murray and worked in Murray. Now, before I came, I'd been studying in night school and then studied shorthand, and President Francis M. Lyman was the president of the European Mission, and he had me take minutes of the conference. And when he learned that I was coming to Utah and coming alone, well, he was quite interested, because I wasn't very big and large in those days. And he was quite interested there, and he says, "Well," he says, "I'll tell you, Thomas," I said, "you go." And he says, "You're going to be a leader in the educational circles among the people of our faith." I remember him saying that, and it made an impression on me. And when I came here and worked there in a dairy there for 3 years there, a little east of Murray, I will never forget the many, many temptations that I had to just go to the dogs and become a terrible man while I was working there. And every time when the temptation almost came to the place where I was about to yield, then that promise of President Lyman's would come to me: "Remember what you're going to do when you get to Utah." And it saved me over and over again. Well, about the end of the 3 years' time, I received a letter from my father. I'd been sending all my money to the Liverpool Emigration Fund, and I received a letter from my father, and he said, "Now, if you can only get $100, Thomas, we'll be able to sail on a certain ship that was leaving in August. Now, will you get it?" Well, here I was just a little English boy working around there in Murray, and I knew a lot of missionaries, and $100, you know, in 1905 was certainly more than $100 at the present time. And for a person who wasn't known and just a kid there, it wasn't a very easy job for me to get that money. So I went around hunting in every direction for that money to these different missionaries. Nobody could lend me $100. My boss couldn't lend me $100, and I didn't know what in the world to do. And I said my prayers, as I always do that night. And then next morning, I went out to milk at 5 o'clock in the morning. And when I was sitting there, just about to sit at the stool and start milking the cow, the thought came to me, why don't you pray for this one thing alone? And I just simply put my stool there to the side, and I went out in the bushes. It was just beginning to get twilight. And I remember kneeling down and just talking to the Lord, just as one man talks to another. And I said, Lord, I do need my folks. I haven't seen them for such a long time. I'm homesick, and I would like to get them. Can't you do something to help me get that $100? That's all there was to it, but something happened. Because from the top of my head down to my feet, it seemed as though a certain something, just slowly, a soothing influence, went from my head to my feet. And I remembered an experience I had in England when I was terribly ill and my father administered to me. And while he was administering to me, I had that same identical experience, right from my head to my feet. While he was talking, I felt that influence go through me, and I was anxious for him to get through so I could see whether or not I wasn't all right. And as soon as he went out of the room, I got up in bed and started to dance around there. For some cause or other, I was cured, and I remembered that influence that I had at the time that my father administered to me. That makes too much noise. Well, I well remember that experience, and because it was identical with the one I had at that time, I said, I'll get the money. I didn't know how, but when I went back to the barn there, my boss was milking, and he says, Thomas, come over here. He says, will you promise to stay with me until that money is paid if I get it for you? I said, why, yes, but I thought you said you didn't have any. Well, I'll get it for you. I didn't know anything about signing notes. So we went to the bank there in Murray, and Mr. McMillan, who a few years ago died in an airplane accident, I was introduced to him, and he says, you know, this man's got a crazy father. He wants him to get $100 so he can emigrate and so forth and so forth. McMillan looked at me, and he says, well, I think we can let him have it. And that money was on the way by 11 o'clock that morning. Well, there was, it's these little experiences that's kept my faith in prayer. I can't give it up, because those made an impression on me that stayed with me for the rest of my life. Well, we finally brought the folks to this country, and then it was ready now for Thomas to go to school, because he was going to go to school when the folks came to America. And then, because of the 8 children that my father had, mother said, well, Thomas, I'm just a little afraid that you'll have to work for a year longer before you can go to school, because father's got to have help. So I went down to the Lehigh Sugar Factory, and Bishop Gardner was the superintendent of the factory, and he wanted me to work, I wanted a job. And he said unto me, he says, well, he says, how old are you? I says, well, I'll be 20 in 2 more months. He says, well, you're as old as a man, but you're not a man's size, and you can't do the work of a man. No, we can't hire you, so because you're too little. So I started for home on my bicycle from Lehigh to American Fork, and I remember crying like a baby. And when I told my father what was the matter, my father looked at me and says, thee go to school. And I went into school in the 7th grade within 2 months of being 20 years of age, and I've never been out of school since. Well, it was very interesting as I worked there in the school. I was a little more mature than the rest of them, and because of it, I finally got into the high school, and I was pretty good with my algebra problems. And I well remember, because I'd get all the problems every day, why the teacher would say, now, why don't you do like Thomas does? Why don't you do like Thomas does? And I just enjoyed that. It was good. And as the problems became more difficult, why, I was having trouble, and then I noticed a certain girl was getting them all the time. And I thought, by George, is she going to outshine me or something? And I looked, and then I thought, now here's a way to keep up my reputation. I'll just go with her and arrange with her so we get our problems together at night. And it saved me, do you see? But it did something else. Because I fell in love with that girl. And she became my wife and is the mother of all of my children. And it was a great experience, I want to tell you. Well, and anyway, I kept company with her for 4 years, and I wanted to treat her. I wanted to buy her ice cream sodas, even though I didn't have much money. But she just wouldn't let me. She knew that I had an ambition to get a PhD. And she says, Thomas, no, you can't waste any money on me. I'll get along without the ice cream sodas. We're going to get that PhD, she said. And at the end of 4 years, I was in the junior in college here, and we decided we'd get married. I had a janitor job here. And up until I got the janitor job, I don't know how it existed, but I lived on 35 cents a week. People won't believe that, but I've got the figures to prove it. And I had a janitor job for $15 a month. So Mother and I, we just arranged it now so that, let's see, we pay $8 for rent, and then the $7, divide that into four, I believe we can make it. And she says, I think we can. And innocently alike, see, it wasn't bravery, it wasn't courage, it just innocence. We did get married, and then we came to the BYU for my senior year. And when Brother Merrill, Amos N. Merrill, met me, says, well, you ought to be congratulated. And he was good. Then Brother Higgs met me, says, you darn fool. He said, what did you get married for? You haven't any money. I said, well, I have two. I get $15 a month. He said, well, how can you live on $15 a month? $8 for rent, $7 to live. It'll work all right. Then I was the first janitor in the Mazur Memorial Building, the very first one. And I had the job sweeping for $15 a month. In a few days, Brother Higgs says, you go down and fire that engine. I said, well, but I have this sweeping. Go and fire that engine. And I thought I'd been given a double job. But when the end of the month came, I had $30 instead of $15. And it worked. I don't care what it is that you want to do. Just give your mind to it and go after it, and you can't accomplish it. This weak back stuff that you meet all the time is enough to make a man tired. Well, then that was a busy year, I want to tell you, because I had the double janitor job I was interested in oratory, and I was interested in debating, and I took one of the leads in the opera Boccaccio. I know some of these older ones remember how I used to trance along the stage singing, I'm the father of a princess. Those were great days, I want to tell you. And then Brother Brimhall, somehow or other, he told me one morning, he says, well, you're going to graduate now, and he says, we want you to give the valedictory address. And I was quite bothered about it because B.F. Larson and Carl Eyring and Judge Worthen downtown, a number of others were members of the class, and I thought they ought to do that. He says, no, you give the valedictory address. And I did, and then I had the principalship of the Bighorn Academy, and we went up there with one son and left there 3 years later with two sons. And there... At the end of the first year, we're only going to be there 1 year because we were going east for a PhD degree. I'd had a number of opportunities while I was in college to take this job, that job, that job. And every time I was about to do it, somebody would say, well, Martin, you've talked so much about a PhD. Have you given it up? And that'd jolt me, you know, and I'd come back in. Well, at the end of the first year, I received an increase in salary. Then the next year, I received an increase in salary. Then the next year, I received an increase in salary, and Mother said, no, you can't take the increase in salary. We're going to go, and we're not going to stay here at all. And she just simply put her foot down on it and saved the day. And we went to Cornell University with $800 and two sons. Well, by Christmas, we didn't have any money. What should I do? So I wrote to Brother Cummings, and Brother Cummings says, yes, I'll lend you some money from the church school fund, but we'd like you to come and be the principal of the Emory Academy. Well, my major professor advised me to take that principalship, for 1 year, and in the meantime, I'd probably have a fellowship at Cornell. So we came back to Castledale, and I was the principal for that 1 year, and another son was born. So we had three of them. And then I went back to Cornell University, and we had a wife and three sons, and we just got along fine when that fellowship came, although we had to struggle. And at the end of that time, I'll never forget it, when I took my final examination, the mother and the three sons, they wanted to be the first to see me, and it was arranged that I'd look through that upstairs room and I'd give a certain kind of a wave if I were successful in the examination. Well, I was successful in the examination, and I went to the window, and there they were, mother and the three boys, and they waved back. Those were great times, I want to tell you. Well, then I wanted to come to the BYU or to the USAC for my particular line of work, and in my attempts to come to here, there was no opening at the time, but there was a $2 million drainage project down in Millard County, and also they were needing a soils man for the Utah-Idaho Sugar Company, and they needed a principal of the Millard Academy. And Adam S. Bennion and President Harris both advised me to come for the time being and be right here when an opening would come. So I did come, and then positions kept coming. And I was asked to go to Arkansas and to New Mexico and to Illinois and to Purdue, and several opportunities I had to locate after I came here, and my professors back there just didn't like me coming back here at all, and they wanted me to go. Well, I was there for 2 years, just almost 2 years, and then came a telegram from one of those eastern universities offering me a position and expecting me to come, which would pay me the same salary I was getting at that time. And I turned it down. 3 months later, I received another telegram. Scoured the country over. We can't find anybody to meet our needs, only you. And then they offered me $1,000 more than I was getting at that time, plus a home on the campus. Well, I was ready to go. You bet I was ready to go. But for some cause or other, David O. McKay, President Hinckley, had David O. McKay come down to Hinckley for some cause or other. And then I was rousted out of bed about 6:30 in the morning. I went for an automobile ride. I didn't know what it was for, but I learned later that David O. McKay wanted to know what kind of a fellow I was. And then we had quarterly conference that morning, and I was asked to speak. And then at the end of the conference, the High Council was asked to meet. And I was going to leave, and Brother McKay says, "Stay right here, Brother Martin." And then he talked to the High Council, and then suddenly he turned around. He says, "What's on your mind, Brother Martin?" I says, "Well, what's on my mind is I want to go back east to this university. There's the most wonderful opportunity I've ever seen given to any man, and it's a big salary, and all these wonderful things that would happen." Then he told the High Council, and he says, "I want to tell you that if Brother Martin will stay with the church school system, I want to tell you right now, he may never make as much money as he makes back east, but he will do just as well financially as he'd ever do back east, and he and the Lord will bless him, and I promise him in the name of the Lord," and a number of other things like that, you know. And he says he wonder how things have worked out the way that they have worked out. And I want to tell you right now, he said, "Now what do you say, Brother Martin?" I says, "Well, what can I say? When an apostle of the Lord promises me in the name of the Lord that this and this thing that will happen, why, you've tied my hands. I can't do anything." So I send a negative reply. Then Brother McKay says, "My, I'm glad that you've decided to stay with us. If you could see what's on my desk now," he says, "you'd be a happy man." Well, within 2 or 3 weeks, I was located here at the BYU. And things have just gone famously ever since. And I had many another opportunity. And finally, I received a letter from one of the faculty members there at Cornell University. "Stay with the damn Mormons. We're tired of trying to get you located back here." So I'm with the Mormons yet. Now then, has it paid? Has it worked out? Why, of course. I'm on my 31st year here now. And I want to tell you the way things have happened. Of course, while I was back east, 3 children, that was a big family. We were through. But when we located here in Utah, the atmosphere of something worked because we had 4 more children. And so we had a much bigger family as a result of it. And then things worked out unusually well. I have been to Europe twice. And one of those times I went to Russia. I remember talking to my wife and family and saying, "There's a convention there in Russia. Don't you think I ought to go? Where are you going to get your money?" I said, "Well, some people go. Is there any reason why I can't go?" And I remember William saying, "Why, Father, I believe I'd go if I were you." And I said, "Mother, what about it?" He says, "Well, I found this about you, Thomas. The devil, you need any money, you seem to know where to get it." And we got the money, and things worked out. And while I was in Russia, I pinched myself time and again to see if it was real, because I never realized that such a thing would happen to me. And I was so happy that it did happen. Then I took my wife with me, even though she was afflicted at that time, to England in 1936. We had a hard time, but we had some great plans. And our plans were, you know, to just go every 4 years to some part of the globe. We were going to have a great time. And how we figured for December the 1st, 1950. And we'd figured the wonderful things that we're going to work out, but each time our affliction got worse and worse. And by the time the 1st of December 1950 came around, when we were going to do so many wonderful things, within 16 days after that she passed away. Well, that was a disappointment to her, disappointment to me. And I suppose things will ultimately work out all right, but it's a little hard to have to put up, as you know. Well, then in addition to that, I've been able to send two sons to Germany for 5 years. And then, I don't know, with the things that I possess and the money that I, that the house, that, the home that I have, and what my children have been able to do, I think they've lived a respectable life and gone places. I don't know just how to explain how things have happened, but I look back to the time when David O. McKay said, "You will never make as much money, but you'll never suffer because of money." And you'll wonder how in the world these wonderful things have happened to you if you stay with the church cool system. So I'm very happy that I stayed with the church school system. It's unusually fine to be able to make these plans and just simply set something in your mind and go after it and see that the thing should come about. I never thought when I worked in thinning sugar beets for $1 a day and picking raspberries for 65 cents a day and being kicked around from this place and that place and so forth, that ultimately I'd be able to tell them where to head in at. And it all came, why? Because of the efforts. Now, we've done things and it just seems impossible how we've done these things. And as I said before, it isn't courage. It's just innocence. We dropped into peculiar situations. And you can, if you can't swim, you can drop in the middle of a swimming pool anytime you want to. And you'll get to the end, to the side. You won't drown. And that's the way it is with everything that we tie ourselves up with. You people can have the same identical experiences. And there isn't anything that you can't accomplish either if you'll only set your mind to it and go right after it. And then just hang on. And just don't just get a little cynical and quit towards things of a religious nature, but hang on to that religious spirit so that the Spirit of the Lord can work upon us in a way that we can't help but make a success. I do like what, whenever an impossible situation comes around, I do like that Old Testament Joshua when he was trying to do something that was practically impossible for him to do. I like it when the Lord says, be strong, be not afraid, neither be dismayed, for I, the Lord, am with thee whithersoever thou goest. And if we'll just watch and just call upon that wonderful spirit and let it work upon us, I want to tell you there isn't anything on earth that can stop us from accomplishing anything that we want to do. If you'll do that in righteousness, I want to tell you there's a certain halo, as it were, will come about the body, and everybody you come in contact with will feel that halo, and that every one of those people that you do contact will do everything possible to help you to accomplish the things that you're after. This is a great life, and there's no reason on earth why any of us can fail. You people have got great problems to solve. I know you have, but you're capable of it, and go after them, and go to the top of the world, no matter how great the problem might be or how big the position is. You set your mind to it, and you can get it. I know that you can get it. And take that fine girl with you, and marry her, and let her help you in getting these things over, because you'll make a success, and because of the efforts that you're putting forth, the children will be born, and they live on this higher social intellectual level, and their children will repeat it, and for generations yet unborn, these young people will just rise up and bless you because of the efforts that you make right this particular year in this university. That you work to that end is my prayer in the name of Jesus. Amen.